is the Non-School Introductory Readings in Philosophy group, recording from March 20th, 2016, on Plato's dialogue, The Crito, led by Brian Wilson.
So let's just go around, let's just introduce ourselves real quick. If you've done a PEL Non-School seminar before, you can be like, hey, I've never done this, or hey, I've done one, or whatever. I'll start. So Brian Wilson, hi. I teamed up with Mark because I run a program called Combat and Classics, which is a St. John's College program, and I run online seminars for free for veterans in active duty, U.S. military. Yeah, I've been doing that for about 3 years, St. John's grad. Steve, you're next on my little column, so you want to go next?
Sure. Steve Kurtz, New Jersey, and just lover of philosophy. Participated in one conversation on Dennett's Consciousness Explained. Was a little bit too advanced for some intelligent conversation. So I'm hoping this is more my speed. I'm all set.
Thanks for coming, Steve. Sure. I think we got Stacy. Hi, Stacy.
Yeah, this is my first PEL Google Hangout, so I'm excited. I think you picked a fantastic material to start with.
Thanks.
And I've been a member for about a year now.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming, Stace. We got Roger next.
Hi, I'm Roger Crandy. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska. I've been a PEL citizen for a couple years. This will be my first Google Hangout.
Terrific. Thanks, Roger. Thanks for coming. Nick, you're next.
What's up, guys? This is my first time doing this. I stumbled upon one of your podcasts. Thought it was pretty cool. Thought I'd check this thing out. I actually didn't do the reading, but I'm very interested to see what you guys have to say.
I didn't do the reading either because I hate spoilers. So I just want to find out what happened.
Nice.
I'm kidding. I actually did read it. Justin, you're up next.
Hi. I'm from Denver, Colorado. This will be my second not school session. The first one I did was Dennett's Consciousness Explained with Stephen.
Cool.
So I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to this.
Great. Thanks for coming. Judy. No? Judy, you're going to pass? It looks like maybe Judy's like getting the espresso ready, getting fired up for some Plato. Let's swing back to Judy. James, hi.
Hi. James Lee. I'm from Syracuse, New York. This is my second not school thing. First one I did was on an introduction to analytic philosophy.
Cool. Kathy, talk to me.
Hey, I'm Kathy. I am from Alabama. I live in Arlington, Virginia. This is my first PEL hangout, and I've been a member for fewer than 30 days.
Cool. Thanks for coming, Kathy.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, guys, so how we're going to try to run this, but, you know, we're all members of the polis, right? So if you guys want to vote to execute me and do something different, we can do that. But I'm going to try to run this like a St. John seminar where I just ask an opening question and we just go, right? And it's important to think about seminar like we're all on the same team and we're all like on the same basketball team. And we're just passing the ball around and whoever's got the best shot, take the shot, right? So it's really about building on the opening question, asking further questions. And important in this is so that we're all on the same page, right? Is trying to stick with the text as much as is humanly possible. If there's something in the text which you don't feel like is rational or reasonable in kind of the purest sense, right? This does not make sense. Then that's absolutely fair game. And if you have an analogy or a metaphor, or, you know, even an outside reference, it's fine to bring that in. But we really want to try to tie it into the reading as closely and as tightly as we can. Make sense?
Yep.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Cool. So I want to start around line 45. 45C, Socrates says, "My good Crito, why should we care so much for what the majority think? The most reasonable people, to whom one should pay more attention, will believe that things were done as they were done." So I think what Socrates is saying, and he builds further later on this, is with the doctor-trainer analogy, is that you shouldn't listen to the majority, you should listen to people that know what they're talking about. But my question is this a contradiction with the fact that he was convicted by a jury that was just a majority of the jury and a very small margin? I'll give you the cliff notes that the decision was lost by 30 votes out of probably 500. So the voting was around 280 to 230 in favor of executing him. So on the one hand, he says we shouldn't listen to the majority. But on the other hand, he's going to suffer death at the hands of the majority. So my question is this a contradiction? Is Socrates laying out a contradiction?
I think the argument against it being a contradiction is that it wasn't, the legitimacy of the decision was not that it was a majority. It was that it was the state, and that he says that you should do what the state says to do. Sometimes the state's going to do some stuff you don't like, but you have to do what it says because you want the state to be in place and respected, I think.
Couldn't you see the state as the majority itself?
Well, I think that's pretty clear. If you go back to the apology, the state is embodied by the majority. So we had, I think, 500 jurors there, and their job was to embody the majority of the state. So I think you're absolutely right that Socrates really believes that the majority rule and the rule of law is the most important thing, even though he believes that if not the process itself was corrupted, but the trial, he definitely doesn't believe in the results of the trial, his conviction, or his sentence, but because it is the rule of the state, the rule of majority, he's going to go ahead and agree with it.
So wouldn't that be a contradiction? Because wouldn't the state represent the masses or the will of the people?
If it's just that, if it's just like direct democracy, then yeah, you're basically saying that you should hew to the will of the majority, but it isn't a direct democracy, so I guess that's where the contradiction is.
So because the jury is selected rather than...
Or whatever, like, whatever's in between direct democracy and what actually happens legitimizes it.
Right, they become the embodiment of the state.
Right.
So is the warden at the jail an embodiment of the state?
No. Not in my opinion. The warden of the jail he's acting on the will of the state. He's following the law, but he's definitely an individual, and he's actually seems willing to break the law a bit as well.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm leading towards is, you know, it's Crito implies that they'll let him out, right? And he also kind of implies, and Socrates kind of implies that the state will go, yeah, that's fine, you can break out. So it seems like there's something in kind of the written law or the official law versus the unofficial law here. And it seems like Socrates is hewing to this official law, but I'm stuck on this, and I'm just, you know, if somebody can clear it up for me, and this is part of the reason why I picked this is because, for me at least, it's very confusing, is that Socrates wants to hew, I feel like, to this official law, but it's a law that was passed down by the majority, right? I can't get around that. You know, the jury isn't the lawmakers, right? They're just deciding what's, you know, is this case against his impiety just? They didn't make the law, but they're deciding on the application of the law. But you swing those 30 votes, and Socrates' official position is based on a majority opinion, not on this tightly bound official law. Am I reading that wrong?
I think that it's because the majority has ruled in the court of law, it becomes a statement made by the state. So if you look at 49, I guess it's 49C, he says, nor must one, when wronged, inflict wrong in return, as the majority believes, since one must never do wrong. So what Socrates is saying is that the state is divine, if you will, and just because the majority acted as jurors in a way that he believes is wrong, doesn't mean that he can then inflict another wrong on the state. Two wrongs don't make a right.
Is the state held to that same standard?
Are you trying to point out a distinction between the law and the individuals involved in the law, Brian? Or?
Yeah, I mean, in 52A, Socrates lays out kind of his responsibility in the state, and he says right at the beginning, so he's speaking as the law, and this is interesting. Actually, can we do a quick translation check? So 51C, when Socrates begins talking after Crito says, I think they do, Socrates in my translation says, reflect now, Socrates, the laws might say. I'm wondering if anybody, I know most of everybody's got the Hackett, but if you don't have the Hackett, or maybe if you have like a different version of the Hackett translation, I'm wondering if anybody's got a different translation than the laws might say as that first line.
I think I do have a different translation than you guys. Yeah, it says, then the laws will say.
Yeah, so it's the same. Yeah. Okay. It's interesting that he didn't say the lawmakers, he didn't say the rulers, he said the laws. He's giving voice to the laws, right? As he goes down through here, and so we get to 52A, and the laws are saying, yeah, we only propose things. We do not issue savage commands to do whatever we order. We give two alternatives, either to persuade us or to do what we say. Right, so the laws in Socrates' explanation, which it seems like it's interesting because he's He's not doing what he did before with Crito, where he's just talking and he's trying to, you know, build a logical case or a rational case. He's now taking on the embodiment, speaking as the laws. So there's a level of separation there, which I think is interesting. But the laws have this agreement with the citizen that it is, you either have to do what we say, or you have to persuade us. So why doesn't that go both ways? Or maybe it does, and, you know, maybe his trial was that opportunity. His trial was to persuade the laws. But it seems like it wasn't to persuade the laws, it was to persuade the jury. So I'm just wondering, again, if this is more of balance between citizen and state, I guess what's the alternative as a citizen, right? I think this is spelled out in here, but I'll just bring it up as fruit for discussion. What is the alternative for the citizen? The laws say obey or persuade us to do something different. And I'm wondering if there's ratio is 1 = 1 kind of thing. A equals A. Is there a rational counterpoint to that from citizen to state?
Isn't that a child-parent relationship that Socrates mentions later?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is, and I'm wondering, and I'm glad you brought that up, because again, he's speaking as the laws. I'm just wondering if there's something interesting from the fact that he's not proposing this, right? The only thing that he really proposes that he says, I have held this for a long time, is in 49b, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, where it's never right to do wrong, even when you're countering an injustice, right? And he says, Socrates says, I have held it for a long time and still hold it now, that doing wrong is never good, right? Even in response to wrong. So this reads to me like a turn the other cheek kind of thing. If I'm reading that wrong, then please tell me. But now when he's talking about being the laws, when he's giving voice to the laws, he's saying you have two options, right? Do what I tell you or persuade me otherwise. So it seems like there might be a contradiction. Well, there's not a contradiction, but that's just how he's laying out potentially the relationship between man and the state, right? The state says, you have to do what I say, or you can persuade me. I don't know how you do that necessarily. But then as a virtuous human being, Socrates holds, there, I can never do wrong for wrong, right? And maybe I'm just reading that wrong. Maybe it's not. Maybe he can balance injustice, but he can't do a wrong to balance injustice.
No, I think that, I don't know how ancient Greek democracy works, right? But like, in any democracy, right, the citizens are subject to the laws, but they also, in either direct or indirect way, make the laws, right? And so Socrates might agree to a certain system where there are certain kinds of contexts where it's okay to, I don't know, address, like, certain laws that are considered unfair, but outside of those contexts, he has, as a, I don't know, an obligation as a citizen to follow the law. And so it seems to me when he's talking about the opinions of the majority, in the beginning, the way I read that was just as another way of saying conventional wisdom, rather than some kind of reference to like the state itself or something like that.
It seemed to me like the argument he was making is that by being part of society, you're complicit in the conventions and the rules of society, and then along with what it provides you, that gives a certain sense of duty. And I think where he goes wrong is I think he assumes that it would be doing a wrong to go against the state, because he's assuming that would be an injustice to disobey the laws of the state. And he's kind of tying the law to justice. I'm not sure that those go hand in hand, since most people would agree that the decision was incorrect in his case.
Well, it's even more than that, right? Because he says if he doesn't abide by the decision of the jury to kill him, mm-hmm. then it's the destruction of the state.
Right.
And that seemed really strange to me as well. Like, how do we get from disobeying to destruction?
Right.
So it seems like a Kantian argument that you have to do what you would want to see universalized, because that's the only way you could get from me disobeying to it dies.
Oh, you just went Kant on me.
I have no idea what I'm talking about, but
sounded good.
Relevant.
I do that all the time.
All right. And that seems to be the only way that like what he does matters, is that it would inspire other people. Isn't that the basis of the argument that even if the state is wrong in this one instance, you still have to obey it because you want it to continue, and it only matters if you think that what you do as an individual matters and that it's going to inspire other people or, you know, erode confidence or erode legitimacy for the state if you disobey it in this instance.
Yeah, well, I think we're getting at what that destruction means, right? So it's that seems right as an extrapolation on destruction,
right?
Um, Where does he say that? I'm sure I have it in my notes. Kathy is writing in her diary while she's doing this at the same time. I think that's you typing, Kathy. Boom! Aggressive mute. That's what I do.
Is that 51B?
Thank you. Do you want to read that for us?
Is your wisdom such as not to realize that your country is to be honored more than your mother, your father, and all of your ancestors, that it is more revered and more sacred, and that it counts for more among the gods and sensible men, that you must worship it, yield to it, and placate its anger more than your father's? You must either persuade it or obey its orders and endure in silence, whether it instructs you to endure, whether blows or bonds, and if it leads you into war or be wounded or killed, you must obey.
Does that seem rational?
Well, I mean, it seems to be what we've... Not a lot has changed in 3,000 years.
but I can leave, right? I mean, I can... It doesn't seem to me like I have a moral compunction to stay, right? If I'm ordered to do something, I can leave. If I stay, then it seems like I'm trying to persuade, right? If I stay and sacrifice myself as a martyr for whatever cause, right? Whether it's, you know, being able to teach virtue or, you know, the right to sell hot dogs, right? Like, it seems like my actions are there. It seems like my actions would persuade either way. But it's like, how does leaving destroy the state? Is, I guess, the question I'm kind of stuck on.
Well, I think it's the same thing if you look in 51C. Socrates is equating it to leaving one's post in time of war. You know, to do so is right, and one must not give way to, or retreat or leave one's post. But both in war and in courts and everywhere else, one must obey the commands of one's city and country, or persuade it as to the nature of justice. So he's saying, you know, he has failed up until this point to convince, you know, he's approached just about every politician in the state, right, and challenged them to think more clearly. If he hasn't created a change in his state and he believes in the integrity of the state, well, you know, he's by abandoning it, he's irreparably harming it, and that it's the same thing as if he was standing a post in war and walking off his post and letting the enemies come in and destroy his state, even as flawed as it might be.
But then we get into this question, like, what's more important, the state or good opinions? If the state's destroyed because it has bad opinions, then why is that a bad thing?
Well, I don't think he fundamentally thinks his state is bad. It's just flawed. And he thinks that is a higher good than, you know, a state that, you know, is hard. I think he would argue that if his state was fundamentally flawed, that it would be right to overturn it. But since it isn't, you either try to make it better or, you know, you simply live by its laws.
Does he take a position on that? I know the laws take, when he's speaking as the laws, he takes a position on that. Does he take a position on whether or not he thinks that the state is good or bad in this? That's what's tough about Plato, right? I mean, and it's what's tough about Socrates, at least for me, is that, you know, when I see, like, Socrates actually saying something definitive, like I pointed out in 49E, oh, he said something, and he was kind of clear. It's exciting, right? But outside of that, you know, he either has this dialogue with somebody where he's trying to tease out what's true and what's not of what they're saying, or in the case of the latter half of the dialogue, he's speaking as the laws. You know, if he was speaking as himself, I think he would speak as you know, himself if he wanted to, but he doesn't. So I'm not arguing at all, Stephen, with what you're saying. I'm just wondering if there's something, and even if it is in the laws, you can still point it out, like, where, where does he say something about that that's definitive?
Doesn't he say that in a way by complying and not leaving?
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. I did find one just because I was skimming on where he stopped using, or where the, at least my edition, stopped using these thingies. So 50D, when Socrates, I think this is when he introduces the laws, when the laws start talking. Then what if the law said, was that the agreement between us, Socrates? Let's move back, right? So the end of 50C, when Socrates starts responding, he says, shall we say in answer, the city wronged me and its decision was not right? Shall we say that or what? And Crito says, yes, by Zeus, Socrates, that is our answer. And Socrates says, then what if the law said, what was that the judgment between us, Socrates, or was it to respect the judgments that the city came to? And if we wondered at their words, they would perhaps add, Socrates, do not wonder at what we say, but answer. Since you are accustomed to proceed by question and answer, come now, what accusation do you bring against us and the city that you should try to destroy us? Did we not first bring you to birth, and was it not through us that your father married your mother and begat you? Tell us, do you find anything to criticize in those of us who are concerned with marriage? End quote, and I would say that I do not criticize them. That's weird for me. Is he not criticizing the logic of that argument? Or is he not criticizing something else about that argument? Or ask another way, is there a way to criticize that argument? Is there an approach that you would take to that argument that Socrates doesn't see? This is one of those long silences that you have to get used to as a seminar leader where you're like, did I ask a stupid question? Or are people thinking? I don't know. Let's let it sit for a little while.
Well, it does seem very contradictory to me.
How so?
Based on what you said, he's being indicted because of a kind of treason, and yet he's saying one mustn't be treasonous. And that's how I read it, and it's so contradictory to me that it almost feels ironic.
Yeah. I think Socrates is sophisticated enough to definitely use some irony. And it's the same thing I started with the majority and the contradiction of the majority. If you want to dig deeper, I mean, we could do a whole Alanis Morissette song about this, but like, isn't it ironic that like he spent his whole life teaching virtue, right? And what you could kind of stretch towards piety, at least to his god, his daemon, as he talks about in the Apology, and then gets, you know, convicted because of impiety. But I'm just trying to suss out these contradictions. Like, you know, he talks about in 47A, which I feel like this is the really hard part for me, where he's saying to Crito, consider then, it's right at the beginning of 47, consider then, do you not think it a sound statement that one must not value all the opinions of men, but some and not others, nor the opinions of all men, but those of some and not others? And as he digs through that, it's a very logical proof, right? I started drawing it out in my notes as far as like, you know, value is equal to good opinion, right? Do not value is equal to bad opinion. Good opinion is equal to wise men. Bad opinion is equal to foolish men. So it's tough because it seemed like, you know, if we assume that the jury as a body is full of wise men, then I'll posit this, even though it's outside the reading, that it's implied in the reading, but it's mainly an apology. A majority of those men before the trial were okay with Socrates leaving. So if they are wise, and if they believe that Socrates was allowed to leave, why wouldn't he accept that decision? If he accepts the decision of the majority to kill him, why not accept it that he can leave?
Because that majority isn't the state.
Tease out the difference then for me, Kathy, because now I'm super confused if that's not the state. If they can kill him and that's the state, but he can't leave even though the state, at least I think, is okay with it, how is it not the state?
Because the state is on record saying kill him, but they're on unofficial saying don't kill him, and you have to go with the official.
Okay, so we're back to that official, kind of unofficial, trying to understand the laws.
And I think also, I think he would have had to have left before getting accused, much less convicted, if he didn't agree. Right? So by staying and living under the laws of the state, he accepts those laws.
That doesn't...
If you refuse to be put to death by the state, but you have allowed the state to put other people to death, are you just?
Say that again, Alex. I need to wrap my head around that.
Well, Socrates is saying I can't leave because the state has demanded that I be put to death. He also makes an argument that you can't disobey the laws just because you don't want to. So I was thinking, why would you be able to say, oh, I shouldn't be put to death, when you've let other people be put to death? Wrong does not requite wrong. You can't repay an evil with an evil. And if killing someone is an evil, then the people who are voting to put people to death are, in fact, paying evil with evil.
So you're
sorry,
saying...
Sorry, there's a lot to that.
No, there is a lot to that. I want to unwrap it. Just going to... Oh, there you go. You're on it, Alexander. No aggressive muting necessary. So, I mean, we're going to come back to 49E again. I have held it for a long time and still hold it now, but if you think otherwise, tell me now. And this is about doing harm in return for harm. So, building on Alex's argument, it seems like the state has a different standard, right? Because apparently Socrates' impiety has harmed the state. And so the only way for us to assume that there is the same standard for citizen and state is for the state to not be able to do harm to someone, even though some individual has harmed the state. Unless I'm reading 49E wrong. Or there's the two standards that we talked about, right? The standard of the state, the relationship is such that or the laws, let's be more specific. The laws require that you obey or persuade. Citizen to citizen requires that you do no harm, you initiate no harm, and I guess if you accidentally harm somebody, then you can't harm them back. So it seems like we have this kind of triangular relationship between people interacting and people interacting with the state. Am I describing that model correctly, or am I wrong in that formulation? I wish I had a secret ballot button. I could just put like a secret survey out. Be like, yeah, Brian, you're dumb. Am I extrapolating too much there? Or is Socrates implying that the state definitely has a different relationship with individuals than individuals have with themselves? Or with each other? Or is it a matter of degree? You know, I think that the... Was it Justin or Steve that read the part about relationship with your father, relationship with your mother, relationship with your ancestors? Let's look at that. 51b, end of A, beginning of B. Socrates speaking as the laws. Is your wisdom such as not to realize that your country is to be honored more than your mother, your father, and all your ancestors, that it is more to be revered and more sacred, and that it counts for more among the gods and sensible men, that you must worship it, yield to it, and placate its anger more than your fathers? So that seems pretty clear, right? It seems fairly clear that beyond what you owe to your father and your mother and your ancestors, you owe something more to the state. But it's interesting to me, he doesn't say your fellow citizens. So it seems like the relationship between father, mother, citizen is similar to the relationship between citizen and the state. But it's not clear to me, unless I want to extrapolate from 49E, it's not clear to me the relationship between citizen and citizen. Does anybody have anything that can clear that up for me?
I think you're right. I don't think there is a relationship between citizen and citizen. I think there's a relationship between the individual citizen and the laws, and the way that works is everybody pretty much gets together and agrees, these are the rules that we will all obey. So when Socrates makes that argument about should you listen to your trainer or everybody else, and he says the trainer, that's what's going on. The person that you should respect most in this decision is you. But you made that agreement to live with and obey the laws of the state. You don't get to pick and choose. You don't get to live by your own individual moral code and deviate from the city, not because that would be just or unjust. Well, I guess it would be, but I lost my train of thought there. Sorry.
Well, no, that's good. I mean, we're teasing this out a little bit, and it might come back to what Kathy said about, you know, what the state is. You know, I mean, when you label something as the state, for me, it seems very specific, right? It seems to be, you know, unfortunately ingrained in me from civics that it's the judiciary, the legal, and the executive, right? It's probably something different in this case, but it might be similar. But it's just, it's still made up of citizens, just like the jury was, right? Now, it might have been like landowning male citizens, but we're going to ignore that fact mostly, otherwise it gets too confusing. But, you know, what is this? What is the relationship between individual citizens, I guess, under the law? Let's take a stab at that. I mean, is it the law? Is it just the law? That is what glues us together. That is what we owe each other. And anytime we interact between individuals, it is the law that is the bridge between that. With father and mother, it's slightly different. But with individuals, is it the law that is the glue or the bridge that holds people together?
Well, I think it's very clear that Socrates says that the law is what holds society together. You know, in 50b, you know, if you destroy us, the laws, and indeed the whole city, as far as you're concerned. So he's really saying that by violating the laws, you're ultimately harming your fellow citizens. But I think it's an indirect relationship. So I think that Socrates believes, first of all, he believes that, you know, doing any wrong to another person is wrong, right? So in, I guess it's 49C, he says, doing people harm is no different from wrongdoing. So directly harming someone else is definitely wrong. But by harming up the chain, if you will, harming your mother and father would harm your siblings. So harming the state would be harming all the other citizens.
No, that makes sense. I think we're getting, at least for me, I'm getting a more rounded out idea of what that relationship is like. It's strange, though, because, you know, Crito is putting Socrates' well-being above the state, right? Crito's a follower of Socrates. I think we can say he's a fan, right? He's got a couple other fans that want to see him released because they believe the state did wrong. Why can't they do that? What's wrong with doing that? And he even thinks that, you know, other citizens will think him, he'll get a bad reputation by not trying to get Socrates, not even trying, but not succeeding in get Socrates to escape. So again, we have this kind of glue, this bridge between citizens that is the law, and we have followers of Socrates that say, this isn't just, this isn't right. I'm okay with going against the law. And there's this unofficial law that says, yeah, you can go. The warden doesn't care. Maybe the law, maybe not the law, but maybe the state doesn't necessarily care.
Well, I think he's saying that the law is the difference between a mob. It's the legitimacy of the group. That the group without the law is the mob, and the group with the law is legit, and so that's why he's not willing to let the group decide his fate outside the law, even in the unofficial law. Because the unofficial law is still a mob rule.
So if you had, you know, if Socrates told me, like, listen, we've got this one dude, we've got Steve, the lawgiver, right? Steve's here so he can answer this. We've got Steve the lawgiver, right? And Steve says this, and he is the state and he is the law. That's what we're doing. Okay, got it. But when he's kind of giving this the laws as a entity, as some kind of thinking, rational organism that can speak and explain itself, and it somehow acts through, maybe it's not a mob, but it's 501 dudes who decided that Socrates was guilty of impiety and then decided during the sentencing that he was worthy of death. That gets super fuzzy for me, right? It's not as clear for me because I feel like there's a difference there. If it was one dude, Steve the lawgiver, this is what you're doing. All right, got it. He's the lawgiver. He's the state. He writes down all the laws or tells everybody the laws. This is what we're doing. Persuade me. Steve's like, persuade me otherwise, we're good. But it's not Steve. Sorry, Steve. It's it's 501 dudes. So why isn't that a mob? Why?
Because all the other dudes, so those 500 dudes get to choose.
So the laws are a product of like debate and deliberation, right? There's like a refining process, right? And so it's not just like, oh, I don't like this, and we're just going to fuck this or whatever. It's like there's been this sort of, there's been this method that's applied, so maybe that's what justifies laws as opposed to mere opinion. And so you would think that Socrates is someone who values that kind of like public deliberation, that kind of discourse and debate. And that's maybe partly explain why he values the law, because the law is a product of that kind of discourse.
But that would imply that it's changeable.
I don't. Yeah. Maybe it's not. I'm assuming like the way democracy works is that you can change laws, right? Or you can, you know, create new laws, or I don't know, get rid of old ones. But I don't know how Athenian democracy works.
So. No, that helps. That helps me a lot because I think that what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that, you know, he had his chance in front of the jury to persuade them.
Yeah.
Right. He was talking to the law, and the law was unconvinced.
And he has his opportunity prior to that to change the law, to influence the law. Mm-hmm.
Is that how you would persuade the law, by changing it?
I believe so. So they went from right an autocracy to a democracy. And the democracy is the collective will of all the citizens. And obviously it's not everyone, because only certain people could be citizens, but all the laws are created and made by the individual by the citizens collectively. I'm sorry.
So then I guess my next question that I'm coming at with this with is, would Socrates agree to any, and since Kathy brought up Kant, we'll go with some Kantian terminology, would Socrates agree to any a priori principles of right and wrong before the state? Right, so we've got this thing in America, freedom of speech, right, freedom of the press, right to bear arms, and these are things that are enshrined in the Constitution but are recognized as natural rights notionally. Does something like natural rights? Do you think Socrates would buy into that?
I'm not entirely sure, because he's going to say that the highest good is piety, which is adherence to the will of the gods. At no point is he convinced what that actually is in any of the dialogues that I've seen. But I think that he would say that the will of the gods is a higher law than the will of the state.
Yeah. No, I think, and that's what's tough, right, is that, you know, if you go back to the Euthyphro, which is usually the first dialogue in this kind of series, when they talk about like the trial and death of Socrates, right? He's questioning a expert in piety, Euthyphro. And Euthyphro can't define what it is. Right? He's like, oh, you're an expert in piety? Sweet. I'm going on trial for impiety. Help a brother out. And at the end of that, Euthyphro is like, I gotta go. And Socrates is like, but you didn't help me. You didn't explain what piety was. So, I mean, I'm totally on board that, you know, being pious is Socrates' greatest good, right? There's something like virtue or piety in Socrates' greatest good, but he can't define it. So then we're at some kind of a priori basis for Socrates of, I don't know, you know? It seems like the thing that he knows, the I have held it for a long time and still hold it now, right, is that you can't harm other people, nor can you, even if harmed, return harm, right? So is that a natural right, or does that get trumped by the relationship with the state?
Just a quick question. What is the law according to Socrates? Is it an entity when he speaks from the perspective of the law? Or is it just a series of texts? Is there an ideal law? Is there a form of the law in that in the world of forms?
Yeah, I think James took a stab at that. Where it's this kind of organic deliberation that gets codified in the law to some extent. We don't know what. And then it... I don't know if you guys can hear my dog barking in the background. He hates Socrates. He's more of a Kantian Hegelian. So is it... I don't know if we have an answer to that, just to give you the bottom line. I don't know if we have an answer to what the law is. Seems like it's something that Socrates really digs, and it seemed like something that he's willing to lay down his life for. But exactly what it is, I'm still not sure. But if you want to take a stab, and unfortunately, sir, I don't know your name because it's showing up as edit when I click on your square.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I dig the edit's just fine.
Edit? Okay, Mr. Edit.
I like that.
You can take a stab at this. Is like, what would Socrates believe that, you know, there is an a priori foundation, like a from nothing, a from the beginning? That's kind of what a priori means. Something from the beginning of the law, or is it just whatever the jury says it is in your reading of this dialogue?
I think that there's I think he sees the law, and then there's forms like justice and so forth, like these ideal principles, and then the law is society's best attempt at trying to enact this, right? And so I can go out and I can try and influence my peers within a democracy to show them the ideal that we should be living by. And so there we can have like an a priori discussion from his perspective, because we can use reason to discern the essential nature of these principles. But at the end of the day, to avoid anarchy within society, if you still consider my views as being deviant, even if after I've tried to convince you and you think that I'm enough of a harm, my ideas are enough of a harm, then I just have to abide by what you have to say. And I've had time enough to leave, and I didn't leave. So there's not a priori law, maybe not, but I think there's principles that are a priori, and I just try and show them to you. Does that make sense? I don't know.
Yeah, I think so, for sure. And, you know, I'm just looking at the introduction on page 5, where Grubbe talks about the aim is not to choose the right, but to become the sort of person who cannot choose the wrong. So what Socrates is saying is that, and what he tries to convince Euthyphro to become, is a truly pious person, somebody who loves the pious, somebody who can ultimately do no wrong, and that's what Socrates tries to confront all of the politicians and really everybody in society whenever they're walking through, was the Lyceum, I think. And he confronts them, tries to get them to reflect on themselves and on what is right and what is best. And if they all do that as a democracy getting together, they will do the right thing. And therefore, the state will become just because the people who are ruling it together are just. And, you know, I'm sort of thinking that maybe Socrates at the end of the day is taking this punishment on himself in order to be an example and to say, you know, this is, you know, I'm an old man, but this is my last lesson to the Athenians as a whole. You know, you got to examine what you do, because if you do something because, you know, I walked around and pissed you off and called you stupid, or proved to you that you didn't know what you knew, that you are doing a great wrong. And I'm willing to stand up and stand for the virtuous and the right and die for that ideal. And therefore, you should go ahead and reflect on that, and you should try to be as pious as possible. You know, get correct knowledge and then rule justly.
I definitely dig that. I just... You know, I like Socrates. He seems like a good dude. But if you're about to die, right, then why not say that? Why not say, like, I accept these consequences because I want to show you the flaws in the system. I accept dying because it's for a higher principle of demonstrating that, you know, the laws need to change, right, or the way that, you know, we Athenians make laws need change, and that there are certain principles that you have to stand up for And if me dying is necessary to make those principles clear, then I'll do it. But what does he say that would lead us to that conclusion? Unless it's just coming back to that 49E again. You know, if that's his fundamental, right, if that's his fundamental a priori argument, is do not do harm even if harm is done to you, why is it in here once, right? And just kind of like a very short piece of the dialogue. And then why does... Hi, James.
...die for that ideal, and therefore you should go ahead and reflect on that, and you should try to be as high...
I think James is watching your lagged video.
Yeah, you know, correct knowledge, and then...
So we can try that again. I want that reading to be correct, Steve. Like, I want that to be the case. But, you know, he spends half the dialogue talking about the laws and arguing with Crito as the laws. Why doesn't he argue with Socrates? Right? Why doesn't he argue the logic? Why does he take on this embodiment of the laws in order to try to make his point?
I think there are actually two answers to that.
Hit me.
The first being, if he's arguing as Socrates... Let me step back. He says, do no harm to another person. Then he personifies the laws. So he's essentially saying the laws should be treated as though they are another person to whom you should do no harm. The other part of that is actually not an actual reason. It was a question I really had for you. Do you really think that he's arguing with Crito? Because Crito never really gives him a good argument back. He kind of just says, this thing, and then Socrates jumps into his whole spiel. So I'm not really sure that he's arguing. I think he's just convinced. I don't know if he's either convincing Crito or if Crito's just like, all right, whatever, he's not going to listen to me.
Well, that wouldn't be surprising with Socrates, right? Like, just, and I think I like your first point. I think you said about, like, having the laws be a part of the conversation, right? Because he basically kind of, the way I'm reading that is, you know, when he starts talking as the laws in, like, 50C, it's kind of because Crito's just, like, not really doing a good job of answering. So he's like, I got it from here. I'll just argue with myself. But, you know, what you said as far as the laws embodying, like, a person, you know, we come back to this question of, like, what is the relationship between laws and the citizen, right? So if the laws is just, Jude Laws, right? Mr. Jude Laws is kind of arguing here, and he says, like, no, you have to persuade me, otherwise you have to obey, right? Are we in agreement? I think this is what you're getting at, Alex, and if I'm wrong, then set me straight. But actually, why don't you just repeat your first point again? Because I think you said something important there, and I'm going to butcher it if I try to sum it up again.
Basically, what he was saying is you should do no harm to another person. Mm-hmm. And then he personifies the laws by giving them a voice through him, which is also important, I just realized. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that the laws are to be considered another person to whom you can do no, or you should do no harm.
You just blew my mind. But the laws are harming him. So that fits into his model, right, of I cannot do any harm to another person, even if I'm harmed.
Right, and not only that, but as I said before, you know, can you really call yourself just if you let the laws put someone else to death, but decide that it's okay for you to leave? And that's, I think part of this is that the laws are that sort of agreement between a group of people to say, hey, these are the rules we're going to obey, these are the things that we're going to do, And if you expect everybody else to obey those laws and then somehow hold yourself to a completely different standard, then you're not only being, you're not only doing wrong to them, you're doing wrong to yourself.
Does Socrates actually think that the state is harming him?
Steve, he doesn't.
No idea.
I don't think he does. He doesn't. And nowhere, when he's talking about death, death is not a bad thing to Socrates. That's not doing something bad by killing him.
But Crito certainly thinks that.
Yes.
Well, I think this is one of those examples of what we talked about, you know, in the ground rules of, like, if something isn't rational, you know, and this doesn't seem to be rational, right?
What's
it doesn't seem to be rational to just say, I'm okay with dying because somebody else said so, right? That seems to be taking this code of doing no harm a little too far, right? But, throughout, I mean, it is... Oh, I'm sorry.
Throughout Greek, Greek tradition there, or recent, at least the post-Peloponnesian War, there was an issue with anarchy. And you can speak out and criticize people, other people and their perspectives within a democracy, but if you're going to undermine that which stands in the way of anarchy, you would be doing the greatest evil.
Wait, say that again.
If you attack and you do harm to that which stands in the way of anarchy, then you're doing the greatest evil, because Socrates really does have a strong faith in the state. And so even to a point where, you know what, I can criticize you, I can say that you're wrong, and I can act out as if you're wrong, and then I'm going to try and change the law. I'm going to do my best to do that. But if I'm not willing to, I'm right. Socrates is right, but I'm not willing to undermine law and order, and so I'm not willing to back down from this. And I love my state. Like what his, it seems to me that it's kind of a logical thing where, ultimately, I mean, my only option is to accept death.
I think this kind of gets me back to like the fundamental, right? What's outside the state that is right? Would be another way to say that. What is pious or virtuous that is outside the state? And we can try that from a Socratic like rationale, or we can just try it from a rational rationale. Like, do I have to worship the state in whatever state I'm in more than my mother and more than my father?
That's a tough one from a modern standpoint, for sure.
Is that what this hinges on, though?
With post the Civil War, like with the kind of slaughter that took place in the Peloponnesian War, it was this is vividly in everyone's mind, and so with that in mind, I think that yeah, absolutely, the state is more important than my brother. It's more important than my father. It's more important than myself. I can try and form it towards the better, but it is the most important thing because it's all that stands in the way of anarchy.
I guess what's the difference between anarchy and living in the state?
The law is like, it's setting the ground rules for behavior that we should abide by. And so it's like a code of conduct. It's basically a way of the minimal politeness that I owe you. Where in anarchy, I don't owe you any politeness, and it's just the will of the stronger.
Well, anarchy is defined as the absence of government, not the absence of governance, right? So, you know, in Athenian democracy, I think Socrates is finding governance which is, you know, truly the will of the people. I mean, you're talking, you know, 40,000 citizens, I think, at around at his time, and, you know, real it's not a representative democracy, so it's a direct democracy. And it is the will, obviously, of the people who have money and land and can contribute, but it's not so it's a, there's a certain level of governance that's agreed to by the people, and you know he's certainly able to leave and go somewhere else if he finds a better way to do it. And I think it's very difficult to connect that to a modern concept because it's very difficult to leave your country. You know, we're talking hundreds of millions of people in general, and you're talking about no direct democracy. So I think, you know, to Edit's point, you know, the democracy that we're talking about in Socrates' time is in such it's the will of the people. It really is. Whereas, you know, it could be argued in the modern nation state that it's not quite as representative of the will of the people.
To go beyond the text, I remember hearing someone talk about, and that I is maybe someone knows, someone was saying that Socrates was quite critical of democracy. There's a Sophocles who had garnered the people to go into war against Sparta. And then after, because of the general people, not these non-philosopher kings, I guess, the ignorant masses led to the destruction of the height of what Athens once was. That Socrates was then critical of democracy. Is this true? And if so, that would maybe he's not trying to serve democracy. Maybe he's just trying to serve the state.
I think it's an interesting point. I mean, the Republic is really where he kind of gets in depth on the multiple forms of government, and specifically that a direct democracy is that which quickly leads to tyranny. For me, I take most of the Republic as kind of a joke. Like, once Glaucon wants a footstool, like, all of a sudden we have to create bronze people and silver people and gold people and stuff. That's a fairly abstract reading, or not widely received reading. That's just Brian's. I kind of want to get back to that. Those are all good points, Mr. Edit. But I wanted to, just because I'm flipping around, and you know, one of the last arguments that Socrates makes is the law kind of brings up what Alexander was talking about as far as the law as a person. And this is on the last page for me. It's 54C. Be persuaded by us who have brought you up, Socrates. Do not value either your children or your life for anything else more than goodness, in order that when you arrive in Hades, you may have all this as your defense before the rulers there. If you do this deed, you will not think it better or more just or more pious here, nor will any one of your friends, nor will it be better for you when you arrive yonder. As it is, you depart, if you depart, after being wronged not by us, the laws, but by men. If you depart after shamefully returning wrong for wrong and mistreatment for mistreatment, after breaking your agreements and commitments with us, after mistreating those you should mistreat least, yourself, your friends, your country, and us, we shall be angry with you while you are still alive, and our brothers, the laws of the underworld, will not receive you kindly, knowing that you tried to destroy us as far as you could. Do not let Crito persuade you, rather than us, to do what he says. Right? So that's the end of his quotation of the laws. And then Socrates is saying, Crito, my dear friend, be assured that these are the words I seem to hear, as the Corybants seem to hear the music of their flutes, and the echo of these words resounds in me and makes it impossible for me to hear anything else. As far as my present beliefs go, if you speak in opposition to them, you will speak in vain. However, if you think you can accomplish anything, speak. I have nothing to say, Socrates. So, it's interesting. Two things that come out as interesting to me on this is, first off, it's not the laws that have harmed Socrates, according to the laws. It's men. And so if the laws are wrong, it's not the law's fault. It's men's interpretation of the laws that are wrong. But it seems like Socrates is still willing to suffer men's interpretation of the laws, even if they're not right. And then, just as a side note, the Korobants were a sect, and their music was highly discordant. So it wasn't a harmonious thing. It was, I don't know, you couldn't even call it like very freeform jazz. It was just like noise.
My translation actually uses the word frenzied.
Yeah. So it's, you know, God damn it, Socrates, just be specific already, you know? Like, just be clear about this. Stop talking against the laws. Because it's like... Yeah, go ahead, Alex.
Well, it's kind of interesting to me that you bring that up, because it made me realize that a little bit earlier, and I'm really sorry, but I can't really give you a whole lot of line numbers, because mine only has the line numbers in the Greek, and it's really hard to line that up.
Baller. That's...
yeah. The Loeb editions are neat, let me tell you. But earlier in that speech, he says something that I found very interesting, and he makes these comments about you should not listen to the multitude, you shouldn't listen to the multitude, you should listen to the one person whose, you know, opinion you trust. But earlier in that speech, he says, you will if you take our advice, Socrates, and you will not make yourself ridiculous by going away from the city. And that's the first thing that kind of struck me. And when he goes to, if he were to go to Thebes or Megara, you will go as an enemy, Socrates, to their government. And all who care for their own cities will look askance at you and will consider you a destroyer of the laws. They don't say they will prosecute you. They don't say they'll kill you anyway. It just says... you'll have a bad reputation. And that's such a weird thing to say, but you made me realize that by personifying the laws, he's personifying the sort of collective opinions of the mass of people who live in the state. If everybody in the state were to suddenly agree that, hey, it's okay to, I don't know, murder someone if they cut in line... then that would be the law. That would be what that, quote, person, end quote, thinks. Does that make sense?
Wouldn't the law be what's binding people together, not necessarily the opinion of the men themselves? Is that the distinction he's making when he says it's the men who wronged them and not the laws? Should the laws just be the organization of people into a civil society, or...
But the laws are just a codified opinion of the mass, or of the people of the state. Everybody agrees, sits down and says, okay, we agree this, we agree this, we agree this. When he says that you can persuade the laws, you're essentially persuading a majority of the people in the state. In essence, by changing the laws, by changing the opinions of the people in the state, you change the laws.
But then why would he make the distinction between men and the law? Because if the law is just the opinion of the people.
It's that codification. It's codifying. It's that laying it down and saying, this is the case. This is what we all agree on. Rather than, this is what 51% of us agree on. Or, yeah. I'll have to rethink that.
You might just consider it like the system, maybe, right? Like, you might think of the laws as like a sausage maker, right? And then the men input, like, you know, their opinions, and it comes out as like some kind of like set of like social norms and, you know, things like that. So I'm not sure if that's right, but it's one way of reading it.
No, that's a great idea, because it's taking disparate pieces and turning it into a completely different product that is still made up of those constituent parts, like a brick house.
But it seems like it's different from men, you know? In that last part that I read in 57C, it seems like laws is something that exists in Hades, it exists in Athens, in the section that Alex read, it exists in Thebes, it exists in Megara. Like, it seems like laws is this thing that is everywhere, right? It's even in the underworld. So it has to be separate from men. Doesn't it?
Actually, I would disagree. I'm so sorry I'm dominating the conversation right now.
Dominate, Alex.
as Mr. Edit pointed out earlier, used the word anarchy, and it got me thinking about where that word comes from, because you don't go to St. John's and not overthink everything. So the Greek word for rule, or arche, is also for beginning. That always puzzled me until I started thinking about it a few minutes ago. Why would you have the same word for beginning or for laws or for any of that? I mean, I thought about what anarchy would be, and I realized I actually can't conceptualize it. And you might think you can, but you would be surprised. I mean, if God forbid, all the countries in the world just ceased to be, and you would assume people would run around and do crazy things. Now imagine somebody doing something crazy to you, like to your family. They do something really, really awful, like killing a family member, and you felt, or you didn't feel, that it was okay to go murder them back, as it were. You were essentially following your own moral code. You are a nation of one right now. You are following rules, though. The group of people is anarchic because it's not following necessarily a particular set. But the second people start saying things like, oh, I killed him. Why'd you do that? Oh, well, he killed my sister. Oh, I totally get it then. That's a rule. Maybe not like a hard and fast rule for them. Maybe not quite a law, but it's what makes people. The ability to reason through those things and the ability to set those things into motion, which is, does that make any sense, or did I just confuse everybody?
No, I mean, it gets back to that idea of a priori, right? I mean, it gets to the RK as the beginning. I've heard the translation of anarchy as without masters.
That works too.
But yeah, I mean, without rule, without masters is simply, I will make decisions and I will suffer for those decisions myself. Without rule is you could extrapolate that out slightly differently or monstrously differently.
We'll think about it as without beginning.
Yeah.
Without a place for you to stop and do whatever it is that you do. That's what I think he's talking about when he's saying that without the laws, or he's implying or something, that without the laws he wouldn't have come to be. Like his parents could give birth thanks to the laws. Uh-huh. And I think that's what that's saying is, even if it's just an unspoken rule that you that you don't attack a town with a mother in labor or something like that, that's still a law that helped him come to be.
But I think that not to cut you off, but I mean, I think that what you just said there, that the laws are necessary for a mother and father to have a child, I mean, is that true?
I think he's interpreting law. You can interpret laws very broadly, right? So you can think of laws as just like you throw in like social norms, you throw in customs, you throw in morals, all that sort of stuff. Any kind of like system of a social arrangement, right? If that's the case, then you have all kinds of rules dictating like how people meet and who mates and who makes children and all that sort of stuff. And if you take that very broad scope interpretation, then yeah, like you might think that having children, you have to have laws to have children or anything at all in order to function in a social world.
I feel like
natural laws.
Yeah, I mean, basically what we're talking about is like getting laid, right? That seems to be. I don't really know if I need the state to explain that to me. And
talking about like gymnastics and training and stuff like that.
Yeah, do I need the state to learn how to do a push-up? I mean, I don't know. Like, this is part of the reason why I picked this reading, because it's so short, but it just opens up this kind of like Pandora's box of, what is law? What is man? What is man's relationship within the law? What is man's relationship outside the law?
Well, I think like you have like you can have like an explicit versus implicit state. So the explicit state is something that everyone recognizes as the whatever either the person or the group of people that are in charge. But then you could have like I don't know like you think of like the you know how you have like Hobbes and Rousseau talking about like an implicit social contract. Like you had an implicit state among like you know people like you know, I don't know the cavemen or whoever. You go far back enough, and they operated on some you know. On these sorts of like implicit rules, and so there was some kind of governance, even though there wasn't something that there may not have been like I don't know, there might have like a group of people or an institution that they recognize as making the rules. Uh-huh. And so by taking a broader interpretation of laws, you're including like the implicit state. You're just including like any time there are these kinds of agreements and cooperation had between people. It's a very broad conception, I guess.
Well, I think we are. We're at our time. So I just want to thank everybody for showing up. Sorry again about the tech issues. We'll have those ironed out. We've got Nicomachean Ethics coming up for next month. And then we've got Descartes, and then we've got some Montaigne.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Yeah, everybody's excited about Montaigne. Yeah, I mean, the thing, like, the way I look at Montaigne is like, if you don't eat your meat, you can't get any pudding. So you gotta work through Plato and Aristotle before you get to Descartes and Montaigne. I'm gonna put there's a link for the Facebook post in the PEL group that I just put on chat. If you guys have any feedback at all about like how this went, good, bad, or otherwise, please post it on there. It'll certainly help us kind of like refine this a little bit better. You know, if you have suggestions for readings, more readings, drop them in there. You know, you guys are obviously all PEL, not school citizens, so you can propose your own. If you don't feel like doing Descartes and Aristotle and Montaigne, but thanks a ton for doing this and. Just take a look at the Intro Readings and Philosophy forum, and you'll see the Nicomachean Ethics and the Descartes and the Montaigne. And I'll update the links that so they're actually going to work, and so you should be able to just click on them and jump right in here. Any parting shots or questions from anybody?
Just one thing. I think it would be really helpful to have a help the people find the text that we're talking about. If we have like an online text that everyone agrees on, and then people can just press the Command F button and like type in whatever it is the keywords. I found like I was kind of distracted at a couple points trying to like find where to go, what and to read along with you.
So the only rub with that stuff is like most of them don't have line numbers, and most of the online translations are not usually as good, especially when you get to the modern stuff. Like you can find a lot of Jowett on Plato that's pretty decent. But for, like, Montaigne and Descartes, it's kind of tough to find decent translations. So it's going to cost you a little bit. I totally get that. It does support PEL if you buy through, like, their Amazon link. But you can actually – I totally dig what you're saying. It's kind of a constant struggle on that. So, like, as your primary, like, you can get used copies of this stuff because nobody reads this stuff for pretty cheap. And if you don't, then absolutely you can go to the online and do the Control F. I've definitely done that before, but it's kind of a balancing act because, I mean, for me, like you can't top like good translation with good line numbers.
There is also I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but there's a nasty habit of people before. I can't remember what, like, I mean, it was basically this past century. People would translate Plato the way they think he meant to talk. So instead of just translating, like my copy actually occasionally does do goofy things, like in Plato's Meno, Socrates suddenly switches from episteme to phronesis, which is knowledge to, or something like knowledge to conventional wisdom, but when it's translated, the guy translated them both as knowledge. So it looks like Socrates is just kind of being a jerk when he kind of like goes back on what he's saying a little bit later, but it's a very important switch. So translations are it's good to have a variety in times.
Yeah, good point.
Is there any, and second question, is there any further readings for the Socrates conception of law? Because that seems like to be really what a good amount of our conversation hinged on, and I was wondering if anyone had any recommendations.
All of them. Yeah, I think, you know, if you want to build on the Crito, if you haven't, like, I feel like it's a good starting point to try to examine that. I would try to do, like, the entire part of the five dialogues and go through Euthyphro, Apology, Crito, Meno, and Phaedo. I think that that's a great start with trying to figure out what he's talking about with the laws. And then jumping over to the Republic, which is a little bit meatier. Not meatier, it's just long, right? So if you can make it through those five, and you're like, I need more, then you can give the old Republic a try. Does anybody else have any other suggestions? I don't want to... Okay, everybody's agreement. Cool. All right, guys. Thanks again. Hope to see... Please, again, leave the feedback in the Facebook link that I put up. And, you know, see you on the forums, and hope to see everybody for Aristotle.
Thanks, Brian. This was great.
Thanks a lot, guys.
See you, guys.